This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Here comes the millennials. They are the demographic that's taking over America. Long have they been mocked and shamed unfairly, but who are they really? What does the data tell us? Are you a millennial? Do you feel ready to take over the economy, the government, and lead? Give us a call. The number is 210-614-8980. If you're not a millennial, what do you think about this generation? 210-614-8980. Email us at thesource@tpr.org and tweet at us at @tprsource. Our guest this hour, Kim Parker. She's the Director of Social Trends at the Pew Research Center. Chris Hayek is a professor of communications at the University of Texas at San Antonio. Welcome to The Source, both of y'all.
Thank you very much.
So, Kim Parker, tell me, first off, we got the definition of a millennial. It seems to be all over the place. So tell us what we're working with here.
Sure. So we actually just recently kind of firmed up our definition of millennials because we had been watching this generation come of age and come into adulthood and sort of adding each new group of 18-year-olds every year to our sample of millennials. And then we realized, you know, we can see these youngest adults today are probably going to be different from the oldest millennials who are going to be turning 37 years old this year. So we decided it was probably time to try to determine a cutoff point for the millennials, even though we know that these things are never exact. So the definition we're using now is that millennials are young adults who were born between 1981 and 1996. So this year they will be ranging in age from 22 to 37 or 38.
37, 38. What about these people? What makes them different?
Sure. So there are some really unique things about millennials. We know, for one thing, that they are the most racially and ethnically diverse generation that we've ever had. The generation coming up behind them will probably be even more racially and ethnically diverse, but only 53% of millennials are non-Hispanic whites, and that's much lower than the adult generations that have preceded them. We also know that they're less connected to some of the key institutions of American life. They're much less likely to affiliate with a religion or to express high degrees of religious commitment or belief. They're also much less likely to be married than previous generations when they were young, and indications are that many of them will remain unmarried for their adult lives. Maybe upwards of one in four of them. They're also less likely to want to associate with one of the political parties, Republican or Democrat. A very high share of them, about half of them, say that they're political independents. But when you ask them which way they lean, they very much lean to the Democratic Party. So in that way, their views are much more liberal than the generations that are the older adult generations. And they have really been the driving force in changing public opinion on some key issues, such as views about same-sex marriage and also views on immigration.
Chris Hayek, professor of communications at the University of Texas at San Antonio. You're doing research into millennials, particularly in regards to entrepreneurship. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Absolutely. I'm a communication professor at UTSA, and as such, I look at social identity and how it's formed through communication. That is, we don't form an idea of who we are just through sitting alone in a room. We basically are doing it through interactions with others and bouncing ourselves off of other people and conversations or nonverbal communication. So I'm researching social identity as it's formed through communication and social comparison among millennial, successful millennial, and Generation X and baby boomer entrepreneurs. And I find that this is an appropriate topic for this, for millennials, because stereotypically the millennials have been portrayed as being an entrepreneurial generation. They're always looking for what's next, and they have that mindset and a search for meaningful work, and these all relate to entrepreneurship. And I found that among entrepreneurs, the millennials seem to compare themselves to the older generations in the sense that the millennials feel like they're being more innovative and charting completely new territory, thinking that the Generation X and the baby boomer entrepreneurs are more likely to start businesses in more established fields like opening a hotel chain or a car dealership or restaurants. The younger millennials that I've been talking to, they're more interested in artificial intelligence. And there's a Colorado and California gold rush in the cannabis industry, for example. So they're finding all kinds of ways to take advantage of new laws and to fuel their entrepreneurship. And I found overwhelmingly that the millennials are also very reliant on the social media presence on multiple sites, and that they find this to be essential for the building of their brand, and that you do need the social media presence in order to explain the quirky and innovative fields that you're a part of, that would not have been necessary to explain being involved in, you know, opening a restaurant chain, which some people can imagine or they think they can. And so the social media has been extremely important. And I find the older millennials are also comparing themselves to the younger ones in terms of the younger millennials' relative lack of professionalism. So they'll, you know, the older millennials complain that it's hard to hire people because they'll get emails where somebody just writes in a subject line, "Are you hiring?" capital R, capital U, hiring, with no message text at all, and it's just it's an email. And the entrepreneur's like, "Well, I am hiring, but not you. Thank you very much." You know, it's that kind of, you know, that discrimination even within the generation. And I find that millennial entrepreneurs also realize that entrepreneurship involves a passion and an idea along with the business acumen to actually sell it and achieve a result, and that they think that the non-entrepreneurial millennials just really lack, they have the passion and the idea, but they lack the business acumen and the ability to carry through and make the sacrifice to delay gratification to not pay yourself for 2 years. And I think that they're finding self-enhancement in comparing themselves to other millennials.
Okay, we got a lot of calls here already. The number is 210-614-8980. Having a conversation today about millennials and the generation gap. Is there still a generation gap? What side are we on? And let's get Amin on here. Amin, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it. And I am a 31-year-old person living here in San Antonio, and I do function very well in today's society as a millennial. And I currently work, and I work at the AT&T Center here in San Antonio, and also as an HEB delivery driver. And the challenges I face, you know, I'm an autistic adult. You know, I face this challenge every day, but I don't let this affect me whatsoever of whatever I do. So I just want to give you that bit of tidbit of information that, you know, there's hope for everyone, you know, not just people who have a disability or not. You know, you just have to make the most of it, whatever you have. So thank you for having me.
I mean, thank you so much for calling in. I appreciate it. And good luck to you, sir. Sounds like you're on the right track. We're talking about millennials here on The Source this afternoon. And what side of the generation gap are you on? We talked about the generation gap. It came up in the 1960s and 70s as we had the Summer of Love generation versus the older World War II generation or the Greatest Generation. And now the baby boomers have grown up, and now they're the older generation, and they're trying to make sense of what the millennials are doing. And so there's still some sort of lack of communication. Maybe we can kind of bridge that gap, bring together the generational divide this afternoon. Call in with your questions and comments. The number is 210-614-8980. The Source continues after this. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. Are you a millennial? Maybe you're a Gen Xer, and there's kind of some tension between those two, not just because of the differences in music, but, you know, they have different views on each other. What do you think about that? Give us a call, 210-614-8980. Ruth is on the line. Ruth, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much. I am chair of a young professional organization called LOOP. It stands for Leadership Organization of Professionals, and our mission really is to equip young professionals to transform San Antonio. So we do this through intentional programming that exposes young professionals to relevant issues and ways to actually get involved in a call to action here in San Antonio.
All right, Ruth, thank you for the call. I want to move to Ferris. Ferris, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. Hi, my name is Ferris Brawny. I'm the chair of an organization called San Antonio Young Professionals. And what San Antonio Young Professionals does is it builds community for young people. It empowers entities in the community to reach out to young professionals and basically engage them. The reason that building community for young professionals is so important, and particularly through organizations like San Antonio Young Professionals, is Well, millennials are, you know, as Kim mentioned, different than previous generations. They don't have racial identities. They don't have religious identities. They need some sort of community to plug into. And San Antonio Young Professionals is basically building identity and building community around nothing more than being young and living in San Antonio.
All right, Ferris, thank you for the call. So let me go to Kim Parker, Director of Social Trends at the Pew Research Center. Are young millennials, are these young professionals, are they on the move?
Well, it's interesting. I didn't mention this in the opening, but I probably should have, because one of the really distinctive things about millennials is that they really came of age and entered the workforce at the height of the Great Recession. They entered into a very difficult job market. So they were really struggling early on. And while they've, you know, gained some more financial footing, and obviously employment numbers are much higher now, we've seen some real difficulties for millennials in the job market, particularly for young men, and specifically young men without a college education. Their wages have actually fallen over the last decade or so, and they've had a lot of trouble navigating this new the new job market and the new economy. There's another interesting thing about millennials and jobs, because there's sort of an idea or a theory that millennials are less wedded to occupations and jobs, and they're on the move and they're moving from one job to the next. And we did some analysis that showed that millennials actually have longer job tenure than members of Generation X do, which was kind of interesting and somewhat surprising. So once they settle into a career, they are likely to stay there at least for, you know, 5 to 10 years at the same rate that the previous generation did.
I want to hone in on what you just said there about how we have assumptions about millennials, and then you went to the data and you find that it's not true. It's not that way. And do you find a lot of that?
That's a good question. I'm trying to think of some other examples right now. One really interesting thing, I was just reviewing some of our data in preparation for this show, and I was reminded that millennials are much less trusting of people in general than older generations are. So they're very connected, and they have these large social networks, and they're sort of connected with the world through technology and social media, but they're very skeptical of people and less trusting than older adults, and also very much less trusting of the government and government institutions, even though they see government playing a large role in solving the social issues of our day.
Well, in preparing for this interview, I was going through recent articles with millennials as a keyword, and one that kept coming up was that millennials were more likely to be scammed, targets of be vulnerable to scam artists. So, I mean, there seems to be a lot of contradictions.
Yeah, that's interesting, and that may speak somewhat to their broader exposure in the cyber world, or, you know, their sort of coming of age in the era of the internet and always being on and always being connected. They may have opened themselves up to more opportunities for that kind of thing. And there's also theories about how they're, you know, were coddled by their parents and are less independent and all of that. Our data doesn't really bear that out, but we do find that millennials, partly because of the economy that they entered into, are sort of reaching some of the markers of adulthood later than their older counterparts did. So as I mentioned, they're less likely to be married. They're marrying later. Many of them are still living in their parents' homes, and they're doing that at much higher rates than previous generations did. And that's particularly true among those without a college education, and more true of millennial men than millennial women.
Right. So that is used typically as a trope to saying, oh, you're still living in your parents' basement, as a way to justify, mocking millennials for not being able to survive in today's world. But it seems like the reality of that is that these are people who are coming to age when we're dealing with lack of affordable housing, lack of job growth and wages, and a contraction in the economy. So is there a way we can, is that the narrative that we should be looking at when we hear that statistic?
Yeah, and another thing that's important to point out is that part of the reason that they're launching into their careers and maybe living at home longer is because they're going to college in much higher numbers than previous generations did. And they will be the most well-educated adult generation that we've ever seen. So that's sort of the flip side of the still being at home. For some of them, it's because they're pursuing higher education, and, you know, it makes sense economically sometimes to stay at home while you're doing that. And then, you know, they're more prepared to go into the job market and in a somewhat stronger position.
Let's go back to the phone lines. A lot of callers. This is Drew. Hi, Drew. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, David. Thank you so much for having me. My name is Drew from MOVE San Antonio. We're a millennial civic leadership organization here in town. And I heard earlier from your guest that our generation is very entrepreneurial, innovative. We're risk takers, and we're also digitally savvy. So my question is, using all of the attributes that our generation possesses, which is mostly politically independent, entrepreneurial spirit, willingness to serve, and this moment of enhanced civic engagement, what does the future of civic leadership look like for millennials?
All right, Drew, thanks for that question. So let me start off with Kim Parker, then I'll bring in Chris Hayek on that. Go ahead, Kim Parker.
So what does the future look like for millennials?
With civic engagement, civic leadership.
Right. So it's interesting to note that by 2019, millennials will be the largest adult generation in the population. So they're going to have an outsized impact across all ranges, across all dimensions of society. They'll also be the largest generation in the electorate. So their influence at the voting booth will be significant. And as they get older, you know, I mentioned the oldest millennials will be 37 this year. They're going to move into leadership positions in business and in government. So their orientation towards policy, towards business, towards you know, all of the issues that they feel passionately about, they'll be able to make that, they'll be able to impact more from a leadership perspective as they get older. So I think that you know, if they hold their set of views and orientations as they continue to move into adulthood, they could really change things on a whole range of issues.
All right. So, Kim, we're going to move you to a phone line. So this digital thing that we've got going on here is kind of not acting the way we would like it to. So we're going to call you back and bring you back into the conversation on a regular old phone break. Okay, so I'm going to cut you off there. Let me ask Chris Hayek, professor of communications at the University of Texas at San Antonio, about what you're seeing with the millennials that you teach in the school and their curiosity about the world and how they become civic leaders and their appetite for that.
Okay, absolutely. I teach communication theory and research methods, but I also teach, importantly for this topic, intercultural communication. So it's the theory of human interaction, how and why we communicate the way we do across cultures. So we look at social identities, which is anything having to do with race or ethnicity, sexual orientation, age. All of those topics are explored. And I have found that the students are increasingly, over the 14 years that I've been at UTSA, they're increasingly pursuing topics that have to do with social justice and activism and changing the status quo for marginalized groups. And just this, you know, they get to choose. I offer theories, and then they will do a presentation and apply it to a social context. And this semester they did a presentation on the Me Too movement, marches on Washington, not the most recent one, you know, when there's a wrongly convicted criminal or police shootings, they jump on these topics very enthusiastically and follow through on them. And LGBT issues are also very popular among the students. And there's never any sense in the classroom that anyone is offended or has a problem with any of these topics. That's been in place since I began.
Right. And so when you say they jump on these topics, but the people, critics say activism for slackers. They just jump on there and then they don't stick with it. They may post something online, but is it really going to bring about long-term social change?
I think it's a change in attitude, perhaps, that may carry them into the future. I can't really speak to what happens after they graduate, but at least in school, they're very outspoken and very political in class as well.
So Kim Parker, you're back now on the phone line, Director of Social Trends at Pew Research Center. So the zillion-dollar question is, do millennials vote?
Mm-hmm. Well, they turned out, young voters turned out in higher numbers than they traditionally do in the 2008 election when Barack Obama ran for president. He had a he really motivated those voters. But generally, young adults don't vote at the rates that older adults do, and it's something that people sort of grow into. So it's less of a generational thing than it is part of their stage of life. So the question is, as this generation comes of age, will they vote at rates as high as previous generations or perhaps higher, and what issues will motivate them. And, you know, we don't really know that all. That's just sort of time will tell.
But some of the data I looked at says that they, even starting back with John Kerry when he ran for president before Barack Obama 4 years before, that there was a, quite a bit of millennial turnout in support for him, that millennials will turn out for the presidential election, but not for the midterm elections. That seems to be the pattern so far. Is that what you've seen?
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's true of the general public and true to a greater extent of younger adults. So they're going to be more likely to turn out in a presidential election, especially when the stakes seem high. And I would say in 2020, when we have, you know, many of them will be more seasoned in terms of being of voting age, and will be, you know, they could be very motivated to vote. And we've have some data that we just came out with within the last couple of weeks showing the very significant gap in approval of President Trump. Millennials, you know, much less approving than their older generations, and that gap has been much wider with Obama and Trump than any gap that we saw with young adults in previous generations of Clinton and Bush. So there seems to be a stronger generation gap in terms of presidential approval with this president and with Obama. And we also see a very significant gap in terms of preference for voting in the upcoming congressional election. So there's a big generation gap there, with millennials much less likely to say that they'll support a Republican candidate for Congress. Again, turnout will be a huge factor there, because if they don't turn out to vote, then that gap isn't as impactful on election day.
So Chris Hayek?
Yeah, I just to offer an anecdote having to do with the turnout for the Obama election in 2008, I, for some horrible reason, wasn't able to get to the polls that day, and I, for some equally horrible reason, decided to tell my students that I had not been able to make it to the polls, and I was shocked at the disappointment that they had in me as a role figure of sorts, that I hadn't voted, and it was very verbal and explicit. So just don't tell your students if you don't vote, I guess.
Well, that brings up another interesting question about how millennials are looking at the older generation, because they're having to deal with many of the problems that have been left on their generational doorstep, climate change, economic inequality, the lack of upward mobility, all sorts of major issues, and is kind of like the taking of so many natural resources from the land and leaving nothing behind. So I'm wondering if there's going to be a generational resentment as we move forward along the line. So I would like to hear from some of our callers. When we come back, I got to read some emails. I got to get some people on the air. But the number to call in is 210-614-8980. We're talking about millennials and the generational divide. We want to break down some of these myths that are unfair about millennials and see what's really there and get to the truth of it with the data. And this is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Welcome back to The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies. We're talking about millennials this afternoon. As we talk about millennials, we've got to make sure that we're talking about the different types of different millennials that we have out there. You know, the gender differences, but also the class differences. You know, what about the working class millennials? What kind of world are they going to be facing, particularly with the loss of low-skill labor needs in our community? And we do know that the opioid epidemic is hitting particularly hard the working class, lower income millennials. And so why is that? And, you know, they're not to be forgotten as well. We certainly like to hear about that part of the community as well. 210-614-8980. Got some emails. Ashley, I am a millennial born in 1987. Personally, I'm tired of being derided as a millennial. Let's start recognizing the value and potential this generation has to influence the future rather than focusing on the differences from a previous generation. Here's from Erica. And I often cringe when I'm labeled a millennial. I was born in 1983. I think folks that had to be confronted with the difficulties in finding a job right after college during the Great Recession had a great deal of responsibility for not taking things for granted. Sometimes when you're categorized as a millennial, this has been sort of an irresponsible laissez-faire attitude. And from a 28-year-old on Twitter, millennials can add to the conversation in politics, economics, and lifestyle, especially technology. technology in all areas of life. We are aging into a balance of entrepreneurship, identity, and mindset. In a couple of years, we'll solve a lot through leadership. And let's go to the callers. And let me get Emily Royal. She's with the Rivard Report. Emily Royal, welcome to The Source. And I know you did an interesting examination looking at the data in San Antonio with millennials.
Hi, David. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
So we looked at a Brookings study that really paints a portrait of San Antonio's millennials as diverse and growing, but largely uneducated. San Antonio college grad rates are less than 30%. That means that less than a third of the city's older millennial population actually has a college degree. And so looking at San Antonio, you know, we're seeing a growth, as you mentioned earlier, the second largest in the nation in terms of the growth of the millennial population here. But what does that mean in terms of San Antonians locally? So we also interviewed a couple of millennials for that story, and both of them said something very interesting that, you know, the importance of millennials in San Antonio in part resonates with their use of technology in order to grow businesses locally. And that was particularly interesting and something that stood out in the article that we wrote.
And so it sounds like if San Antonio is not thriving with college-educated millennials compared to other communities, that is that's a problem.
That's right. And what, you know, our interviewees also mentioned, which was interesting, is that, you know, one of the ways that millennials are getting around that is by innovating online. They're able to see national and international market demands and deliver products to people all over the world using, you know, the internet and technology. But locally, that means that people need access to the internet. So we did learn a little bit about how important the digital divide is that people have been talking about recently, and posit that maybe part of the reason for that is that because so much economy for millennials is moving online, the issue of the digital divide becomes greater locally in cities.
Right, and there are parts of San Antonio where high-speed internet is still not available, or it's a challenge to get, and there are people who just can't afford it. And that's a burden for individuals, you know, kids who want to learn. You know, they're behind the eight ball.
That's right.
So we got to figure that out. Emily Royal with the Rivard Report. Thank you so much. Thanks for joining the conversation. So Kim Parker, let me turn to you with the Pew Research Center. What are your thoughts about what you heard about what's happening with San Antonio?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that those were some really interesting points. And just to put the San Antonio numbers in a national perspective, our data shows that nationally about 37% of millennials in 2016 had a bachelor's degree or higher. So it's still a majority of millennials nationwide that don't have a college degree, but that share is significantly higher that do have a BA compared to previous generations. But another really important thing that we've found, which speaks to the growing economic inequality and the widening gap in for millennials that wasn't as much the case for older generations, is that the income gap between college-educated millennials and millennials with only a high school degree is enormous and much bigger than it was for previous generations. It's about $22,000 a year difference if you have a college degree versus if you don't have a college degree. And when you look at previous generations, going all the way back to the silent generation when they were young, there really wasn't much of an income gap between college-educated and non-college-educated young adults. And even for baby boomers, the gap was there, but it wasn't as significant. And I think this speaks to the changing occupational landscape, the changing job market, and the lack of these relatively high-paying jobs for low-skilled workers. So this is a particular challenge for millennials without a college degree. And we've done some other survey work looking at the future of work and how people are adapting to the changing occupational landscape. And we find that the public, and particularly millennials, are very much aware of the fact that they're going to have to keep kind of reinventing themselves, adding skills and adding knowledge to their existing base of skills and knowledge so that they can remain competitive in this changing job market. So they're looking for other ways if they can't, if they don't have access to a college degree, they're looking for certification programs, other types of training so that they can get skills that they can use in the marketplace.
Let's go to another caller. This is Nicholas. And Nicholas, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, David. Thank you so much for having me. So my name's Nick. I'm 27. I have a degree in design from San Antonio College. I'm a designer. I'm a private chef. I'm a cook, musician. I'm just going to real quick plug Launch SA downtown. I have done graphic design work for them. I've met the most diverse group of, and I've lived in San Antonio downtown for about 12 years.
Okay, so Nicholas,
and,
since you're cutting
they
out.
They do a great job.
You've been cutting in and out. So we're hearing from Nicholas. I mean, he's a hustler. He's part of the gig economy, and he's doing all sorts of things. And so is that part of what the millennial generation is looking at, Kim Parker?
Mm-hmm. That's another area that we explored in our Future of Work, Changing American Jobs study. And we did find that the gig economy, while small, is growing. And among millennials, the share who are engaged in and actually getting income from the gig economy, whether it's through driving an Uber or a Lyft or doing other types of jobs where they're able to provide service to individuals, the share is significantly higher among millennials. So I think it was, 10 to 15% of millennials were actually engaged in the gig economy in a sense of working and earning some portion of income from that.
So the emails that we read earlier, people saying that they cringe when they're labeled millennial, they don't really like the term. It's been kind of become a derogatory term for some. It's Chris Hayek over at the Professor of Communications, UT San Antonio. Do you feel that? Do people tell you that? You get that feedback that don't call me millennial?
Yes, actually, I have some friends who are clearly right in the middle of the millennial range who want to be Generation X, or they claim to be Generation X, and they know that's not logical necessarily, but they still, they're just like, don't call me a millennial, and it's just kind of interesting. Of course, that's anecdotal evidence, but yeah, as far as entrepreneurship goes, in reference to the last question or comment, was this side hustle idea, and you can be entrepreneurial, it doesn't mean it's just for a breadwinning job, so you can have several entrepreneurial ventures happening simultaneously.
They also seem to be very creative. A lot of the side hustles are,
absolutely,
there to provide meaning and depth to their identity. It's not just about trying to find the 9-to-5, existence. But so anything of measuring that, Kim Parker?
I'm trying to think specifically.
I mean, seeing how they're not really affiliated with religion, but they try to figure out identity to the greater through arts and culture frequently.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm trying to think of some of the other ways that we've tried to measure this. I mean, they're definitely, this doesn't get directly at your question, but they're very much more open to the ways in which society is changing. So they're open to changes in the way that the American family looks. Many more of them were raised outside of a two-parent household, so they're not fazed at all by cohabiting couples raising children or gay and lesbian couples raising children or interracial marriage, those kinds of things. So they do have an openness to all of the changes around them, and I don't know whether that serves to strengthen a more cohesive identity or whether it makes them more disparate. I can't say that our research has really been able to answer that head on.
So where in the future will the millennials become the dominant political force, with these different sort of attitudes about race and religion and family structure? That seems to be something that we're fighting. That's the cultural war we're fighting right now.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I mentioned, they on the issue of same-sex marriage, they were really at the forefront of changing public opinion on that issue. They were far out and ahead of others in terms of acceptance of same-sex marriage. And as an older generation, which was resistant to those changes, began to die off, and the millennials became adults, you started to see the public change. So they pulled along their elders, but they also changed the composition of the adult population, and their views really had an impact in that way. And we see similarly on the issue of immigration that their views are very different. And just recently, we had a big look at politics and generations, and we found there that they have distinctly different views on race and racism in the U.S. And granted, they are a more racially diverse population, but even when you look at whites, right, among millennials and the other generations, you see that white millennials are much more likely to think that racism is a problem in the U.S. and therefore, you know, more likely, okay, to want to see change in that area.
Kim Parker taking a quick break. We'll be coming back. We'll be talking more about millennials. I want to talk about how 9/11 sort of defines the millennial generation and this constant wars that we've been having. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. Are you a millennial? What does that word mean to you? Give us a call. Number is 210-614-8980. What did 9/11 mean to you if you are a millennial? How does it define your generation or the wars that we've been fighting for almost your entire existence, too? So that, too. 210-614-8980. Richard is on the line. And Richard, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hey, Richard, go ahead.
I had a question. I am a full-time worker, and I would love to be a part and a contributing member of, you know, the homeowners market and society in general. But I've noticed that even though I have an associate's degree and I have a fairly decent job, even a small house in a poor area of San Antonio is well over $100,000. Like, I couldn't find a house that was less than $100,000 unless it was falling apart. And I was just wondering what is being done to, you know, secure that there is, in fact, some sort of, you know, affordable, truly affordable income for people such as myself. Thank you.
Okay, Richard. So there is an affordable housing committee in San Antonio. They're looking at this and they're trying to come up with solutions, practical, actionable solutions locally. But Kim Parker, let's talk about Richard as part of the millennial generation and about how this is a problem for that crew, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we know that they're much less likely to be homeowners at this age than previous generations were. And we also know that their income, when adjusted to 2015 or, you know, current dollars, is very similar to the incomes of previous generations when they were young. So housing prices have gone up, incomes have been relatively stagnant. So that obviously doesn't translate into, you know, a winning formula in terms of being able to buy a house. And another important thing, I think, is that they're less likely to be married, as I mentioned, but also less likely to be living with a romantic partner. And so they don't have another person to pair their income with in order to pool their resources and buy a home. So that's another thing that's, you know, probably making it more difficult, particularly in, you know, areas where housing has become much more expensive.
What about putting off having children?
Mm-hmm. They are having children later. They're marrying later and having children later. But some of our recent research on fertility shows that if you look at women who are of childbearing age or towards the end of that window, just as many women are having children over the course of their lifetime. They're just starting later and doing it in a shorter window. So our data doesn't suggest that millennials will have fewer children, but it does suggest that they're waiting longer to do so and also much more inclined to have a child outside of marriage than previous generations were.
Okay, here's Josh. He's called in. Josh, welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
Thank you so much, David, for taking my call. I just wanted to comment that sometimes I'm a millennial myself, and sometimes millennials, we receive a bad rap of we're lazy or whatever. And whenever I'm in a conversation with older adults and they're making those comments about millennials, they look at me then and say, but you're not a millennial. And I say, well, actually I am. And I think sometimes people lump together all millennials, and if there is a hardworking millennial that goes for it and tries their best, they're maybe just not seen as a millennial themselves. And I just wanted to throw this word out there, relationships, because I think you can't talk about the millennial generation without talking about relationships. They're highly relational. We want to engage with everyone. We want to accept everyone. And with just social media and just all the technology that's available today, I think we're still trying to navigate that and find out how that affects us as millennials and as citizens.
Josh, thank you for the call. Appreciate that. Chris Hayek, professor of communications at the University of Texas, San Antonio. Your relationships is part of what you teach, how to deal with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I've noticed an increase over the last 14 years, at least at UTSA, with students being much more verbally participatory in class and in class discussions, and incorporating social media and technology in the classroom in their presentations. So I'm not at all surprised at the caller's comment that, you know, the media and the relationships are much more important to this generation. And I think that's a very positive sign, and it kind of falls in line with a political engagement as well.
Okay, another caller is Sarah. Hi, Sarah. Welcome to The Source. You're on the air.
David, thank you so much for having me. I have two parts to my question. First of all, I'm 31. I'm a millennial, born in 1987, but I'm also a professor, a government professor at a university here in San Antonio. So the first part of my comment is actually an anecdote that it's probably, I guess I get mistaken for a student at least three times a week, you know, and the shock that because of my youth that I would be qualified for such a position is always a little bit, I kind of cringe. So that comment regarding cringing, being called a millennial, I can resonate with. But what I'd like to mention specifically is that there's a very large number of my student population that are millennials as well, that typically don't fit quite well into the stereotypical college age, freshman in college scene, specifically because most of them are actually military veterans. And so I'd like to posit a hypothesis regarding the ability of millennials to be successful in higher education, because they are coming to college after they've been separated from the military for one reason or another as kind of a second option rather than coming directly from high school into college. That's typical with people who were born in about 1998 and above.
Okay, so the story is that there's a lot of people coming later in life to getting, so a lot of stories about millennials is that there's a lot of delay in getting started. And so are you seeing that, Chris Hayek?
I am. I'm seeing a lot of, we have a lot of non-traditional students at UTSA, meaning non-traditional, meaning students who come, they take a break after high school and come back later. So I have found that that's definitely the case. And I think it lends a maturity and a world experience that's useful in the classroom and classroom discussions, especially. And all the students benefit from that.
And so, Kim Parker, you're doing the research on millennials at Pew Research Center, but I want to ask you about the next generation, maybe that's mm-hmm. these Parkland kids, and what we're seeing from them. It seems like they could be like millennials on steroids. They seem very mm-hmm. motivated and that they're taken to the next level.
Right, and we don't know a lot about this generation yet. So in our standard surveys, we survey 18 and older. So according to our new definition of millennials, so that post-millennial generation, we would only be able to capture the 18 to 21-year-olds. So we can't say much about them. But we are embarking on a new line of research to study teens, and that will give us some real insight into this next generation. And we're looking first at their technology use, because we think that this will be really a defining aspect of their experience. And for this post-millennial generation, they came of age not just with the internet, but with an iPhone in their hand. So their experience of interacting with people and interacting with the world is going to be much different. We don't know much yet beyond about their social engagement, or, you know, this situation, this group of students in Parkland is so fascinating, but we don't have any data yet to be able to understand whether that's reflective of a full generation. And I think I want to underscore the point that while we find generations to be a really useful way to study social change and to study politics and other things that we're very interested in, we always have to keep in mind that they're not monolithic and that all of these things kind of exist on a continuum. And you may find that the oldest post-millennials have more in common with the youngest millennials than they do with the youngest post-millennials who are children now. So that's just to say that, you know, the same divides that we see in society by education, race, party ID, those exist within generations too. So there's a lot of diversity within generations, but we still find it a useful way to sort of understand how the country's changing.
Yeah, so back to the millennials, we talked about defining moments, and for these Parkland kids, it's going to be this mass shooting stuff. But for millennials, I mean, 9/11 seems to loom large in their minds. It was, many of them were in high school when they heard that there was the attack, and that seems to have been a defining moment for them.
I think it was, and millennials were between the ages of 5 and 20 when the 9/11 terrorist attacks occurred. So for many of them, they were old enough to comprehend the significance of that. For this post-millennial generation, this is just something that happened, but they weren't here to experience it. And then in the aftermath of 9/11, the millennials grew up in the shadow of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which were so divisive nationally, and we think really contributed to the political polarization that we're living in now. But again, millennials never have lived in a world that wasn't as polarized as the one that they're existing in now. So I think that, yeah, there are things that really, you know, imprinted on them and will probably stay with them as they grow older.
And growing older, so as you mentioned, that millennials are not monolithic, but nor are they static. And so as they grow, their political ideology, it could shift and change. You know, they say that a conservative is a liberal who got robbed. You know, I mean, as they grow up, will they become hardened?
Well, we don't know. I mean, we have looked back at previous generations and seen that those who came of age during the New Deal and FDR's presidency, they held on to their liberal ideology later in life, and others who came of age, you know, a little bit later, and you know, Eisenhower was their president, and they had a more conservative orientation. That we call them the silent generation now, and they were very much more conformist and didn't make great waves like the boomers that came after them. So to some degree, we've seen groups, generations hold on to their political views and ideologies throughout their life. But it's also true that these things can change over the life course. And so we just won't know, you know, for some time whether millennials are going to maintain this sort of liberal political ideology that they're expressing now as young adults.
And so, Chris Hayek, professor of communications at UTSA, you're dealing with these students, you're seeing them first time. I mean, are they striving for excellence? Is that part of their makeup?
I think they're striving for excellence. I see that they have a very innovative mindset, and they're always looking for the next thing, and I find that very encouraging. And what I found also really encouraging about the Generation Z in this most recent March on Washington is that the older baby boomers and the Xers, we have this stereotype of the Generation Z coming up as, oh my gosh, what's going to happen? They're completely consumed in their devices. And it was really beautiful and encouraging to see them in face-to-face interaction addressing live crowds. And I think that is going to help shake up some attitudes of the older individuals.
Chris Hayek is a professor of communications at University of Texas at San Antonio. Kim Parker, a director of social trends at the Pew Research Center. I'm David Martin Davies. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. Thanks for tuning us in.